Hey everyone, this is Connor. Before we get started, I just want to encourage you to check out our Patreon, patreon.com/podsidepicnic. If you become a patron, you'll get access to multiple exclusive episodes every month. And you can also join our patrons-only Discord chat, where Pete and I talk informally with the Podside Picnic community. So if you like the show, go ahead and check us out at patreon.com/podsidepicnic. Thanks.
Welcome back to Podside, everyone. This is, of course, Carlo, and today it's me and old Pete. What's up, Pete?
Hey, man. I'm doing okay. I'm very happy to inflict a story on you. I don't get to do this often. It's always a joy. And this was a hostile act.
I gotta admit, Pete, when you sent me this one and you even with the preamble that this is the most awful story you've ever read.
I believe what I said was it's the only pro-eugenics anti-Hitler short story that I'm aware of.
Well, that's true. Now that you made me think about it, you're right, I think.
Yeah, there's arguments that can be made. Like, this could be like a serious Verhoeven situation where like nobody gets the author,
death of the author. What can I say, man?
Yeah.
So we're laughing already because this story, it's called The Marching Morons. I even feel bad saying that. C.K. Kornbluth or whatever?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Is it C.K. C.M.?
Hold on. Let me pull up the name.
No, C.M. Kornbluth. Yeah. All right. This appeared, what is it, in Galaxy Magazine, 1955?
Yep.
1951. I'm sorry.
Okay.
April.
I knew the
50s. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's sort of clear to me because everyone even the way that it's written, the dialogue feels very much like I should be reading it like this. See, and then
23 Skidoo.
Yeah, it's like, and then there's a rocket. See, but it's not really a rocket. See, you cop to it. You're like, what? It's like, what? Yeah. What are you talking about? Why is this dialogue like this?
And I would say that one of the more appalling things about this story is that I don't consider it badly written. I just consider it to be badly conceived.
It's an okay for its time period written story.
Yeah.
That is in an extremely bad taste at the very least.
Yes. Yes. And I mean, I will at some point in this discussion, I would like to defend my choice of this. But I think we should start out with just the raw honesty that like this story has made the world a worse place for existing.
I got to admit, Pete, that after this, I had to give it a shot three times. I got to admit.
Okay.
Or not three times. I should say that I had to pause because there were moments in it where I was like, okay, this is frustrating. I'm going to put this down a second and come back.
Yes. Well, I know exactly one of them.
There's a definite hard line where you're like,
when they start talking about sharecroppers and stuff.
Oh, like, my God.
Whoa.
Yeah. Well, that was definitely one of them. Yep. Definitely. I was like, I gotta go cook something now. You're going to stay there, phone. I'm going to pick you up in a second. Yeah. But can I say, Pete, mm-hmm. I mean, bad taste aside, right?
Yes.
Eugenics aside. this is a goofy ass fucking story,
oh,
man.
Oh, it's ridiculous.
Like I was trying to figure it out. Like I was like going, why? What do we have like about 1,000 words of like this Potter who's not even going to? He's like, yeah, I found this guy in a fucking crypt. Let me palm him off to someone else. Bye. And yeah. Goes back to throwing clay. You're like, okay, why did I need to read that?
What this story is missing is a pimp named Upgrade.
You got to say it all at once, right, Pete?
I think we should go there early, or otherwise the audience won't know what we're talking about. God help us, they might read it, right? Mm-hmm. And that's a risk I don't want to take.
I mean, we're going to have to include it in the show notes and spread this virus.
So, I mean, the point I'm trying to make is if you've seen Idiocracy, there is zero, I repeat, zero question that Mike Judge read this story before writing Idiocracy.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's way too much one-to-one correlation.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And I'll say to your point, Pete, this is like, Idiocracy aside, I think Idiocracy was just like the tip of the iceberg, if you will, that we see culturally here in this point in 2024. That's what we see. But I remember at the time, this was still an open conversation.
Yeah.
You know, like before Idiocracy ever aired, like there were people going, oh, you know, the poor people are breeding too much.
Oh, it's still happening. I mean, that's what all of that, what is it called? Like the white genocide crap? That's what it's all about.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the stupidest people on earth are breeding and we're not having kids. And mm-hmm. the end result is, you know, a vast sea of morons. And by the way, I'd like to point out that there are 5 billion people on earth in the marching morons, which is hilarious, given we've got like, what, 8?
Something like that. We're coming on that real quick, aren't we?
Yep. And I mean, this story is a key part of a poison that has been like winding through science fiction since the absolute beginning. Mm-hmm. And I sincerely believe that it's a worthy thing to talk about, because you don't sweep stuff under the rug. I mean, you know, everybody who reads science fiction wants to be recognized as literature. Well, that means you have to pay attention to it and its schools. And one of its schools has been eugenics since the very beginning.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, I think it's tough to really engage with science fiction. Like the science fiction has never really been a good tool, I feel, to really sort of buck trends that are in the wider culture, right?
Yeah, it's a great place for straw men. I'm just saying.
Is this a Wizard of Oz reference? No. I guess what I'm getting at is that it's really difficult for people to understand now just how really into the groundwater eugenics still is in the U.S. specific. Like, I mean, not just the U.S., but it's always been here, at least. I can't speak to other places, right?
Well, it was a very like with the rise of science was the rise of eugenics all the way along. Like H.G. Wells was a outspoken eugenicist who
wasn't that his cousin? Is it Dalton? His cousin? The Madness? I'm sorry, The Wisdom of Crowds, I should say.
Yeah, exactly.
And from that begins the process of people thinking that they can scientifically catalog, which, you know, on the one hand, that's how you get the genome and DNA and all that good stuff. But on the other hand, it's like, oh, well, then we can breed for favorable traits and winnow out unfavorable ones. And, you know, I feel like we should just put in a sound clip of Ian Malcolm in Jurassic Park.
Yeah, well, and that's just it. Like, there's a larger discussion that could be had about whether something could be done along those lines. But I think the more significant one is whether it should be done. And I think we're pretty clearly on the same side of that. You know, like if you leave the genetic pool of humanity alone to do its own thing, the things that we're likely to breed for are like acidic sperm to get through condoms, things like that. You know. And fine, I'm willing to live with that.
You're going for the xenomorph option.
I'm just saying that intelligence has not proven like two individuals to be a great trait for spreading your seed around. And the idea that the smartest people on Earth are going to get together to like fight the tide of the stupids. I mean, have you met who these people think the smartest people on Earth are? It's hilarious.
Well, I did find it initially very, very funny, because if you were to like, because this also has, I would love to find it, but, it's something about like, oh, you should talk, you know, they're talking let's just really quickly, because I mentioned this is a goofy ass story, but it's really difficult to convey. We start off with a guy who is a potter, who is firing, like, he's just like against the clock. He's trying to fire some kilns, blah, blah. And he's got a client that seems to be, you know, just not the brightest bulb in the bunch. Right. Yep. So he's talking to the secretary. They get an order done, and then it jumps to, oh, he needs more clay. So he's going to go just dig up a cemetery, an old
he's
cemetery.
He's looking for copper, actually. He's hoping to across. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, yeah. It's just like, yeah, I'm going to, you know, dig around in an old cemetery, and he comes across like a guy who's, I guess, been in not exactly cryogenics. It's just simply like he's in a preserved state.
Yeah. Like there's some hand waving here, but the basic idea was a dentist was doing a procedure on him and did something accidentally that turns out to be one of the ways that you can put somebody in suspended animation according to the current science of the time. So this guy's been in suspended animation for, you know, let's assume thousands of years.
Yes, yes. He is like Fry from
yes.
From Futurama, basically.
Which is a pretty, I mean, that a malicious version of Fry, the personality of Bender and the brains of Fry.
We're going to build our own utopia with eugenics.
And hookers, yes.
And dictators. But yeah, so then the story just turns on a dime and then follows the man from the past, who is just basically palmed off between like four or five different people who apparently in that entire region of the United States are the only people that work.
Or that are smart enough to work coherently.
Yes, yeah, yeah. And then from there on out, it becomes like this weird, like, so we get the travelogue part in the middle where, you know, whoa, isn't it really wacky here in the future? You know, that part.
Yeah. And our hero comes to the false conclusion that the great masses are being controlled and manipulated by the central bureaucracy of evil people, where in fact it's
even worse. Yeah. It's Ayn Rand before Ayn Rand.
Yes, exactly.
It's a poor cadre of beleaguered and aggrieved super duper men who can only do so much.
Yes. So a very few number of supermen are trying to keep an enormous number of morons alive.
It's so goofy, man. Yeah. Like even like the bad taste aside, this is just so stupid.
Well, and I mean, I don't want to go ad hominem on this guy, but I would like to point out that this man fought Germany in World War II. And from his other books, I know he hates Germany. And also, I mean, I hate to say it, but he is Jewish. And so
it's a very, Pete, I want to say that when I read that, I was like, because parts of these feel like he's trying to be ironic about certain things. And I think the like at the end when you know, it's like, oh, yeah, Hitler, you're like, I don't know. I think this is supposed to be not good. But then it's like Hitler, no. Eugenics, yes.
Yes, exactly. It's like the wrong people were getting killed. That was the problem.
I mean, I do want to point out that I want to be charitable, but also point out that, you know, no one type of people is a monolith. So, I mean, let's face it. Remember the Ice Bay? Yeah, that's a Latina that I didn't want to really know about. Sorry.
I'm now Googling Ice Bay, and I'm probably going to be very mad, aren't I?
I think she did like some TikToks, and everyone was like, basically, she's very attractive, but like, sorry, if you're working for ICE, no thank you.
Oh, that kind of ICE.
Yes. No, we're not talking about like, I don't know, an X person.
Yeah, no, okay, so I just pulled this up and immediately saw a tweet that said Ice Bay could detain me for however long she wants, and I'm closing my phone.
See what I mean?
Oh,
people,
God.
People can't be fucking, like, they can't be normal about things.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it does illustrate an important thing that what probably inspired this story to begin with is that it is a fact that a lot of people act really stupid.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can see being inspired to write something really negative as a result of just walking down a street and listening to people talk. Like, I'm not totally saying I don't understand where this jackass got this. Like, Pete, I do understand. I just think he's wrong.
Pete, do you have no memory of Twitter anymore?
Oh, my God.
I mean, that's exactly what Twitter's for, right? It's like, I saw an annoying person, and that means that everyone is like this annoying person. Let me tweet all about it.
I had a roommate in college that when he was doing his laundry and found a particularly horrible smelling sock, would try and get you to smell it. And that is what I think of Twitter.
Well, I mean, I'm not trying to induce you to come back or anything like that. I'm just saying that, as you can imagine, like, if I were to base like the premises of anything I wrote simply on, you know, like people who annoyed me online, that'd be like, I'd never run out of material, but it'd be very, very, very boring and not very good.
Yes. Not
to say that you can't make a living doing that, because there's plenty of people doing that.
Oh, I was just going to say, yeah, like, there are all sorts of bad ideas you can cash in on. Like, there's no question about that.
like thinking that Hitler had some good ideas, yes. For instance.
And I think we should move along into the story to communicate the horrors therein.
It's so bad, my God.
Once our hero, who is so irrelevant, his name escapes me now.
Isn't it Barlow? It's Barlow, yeah.
Yeah, it's Barlow. So Barlow eventually gets tracked down by the smart people when he's running around what I believe is Chicago. And he's like, I understand you guys are trying to control me just like you control all these people. And they start laughing and stuff. And, you know, they basically explain to him that the world is full of stupid people, and it's the fault of people like him, because, you know, back in the 20th century, they didn't have kids, you know, they like, and then meanwhile, and this is where Carlo put the book down, immigrants and sharecroppers and stupid people had kids instead. And that's what we ended up with. Ignorant sharecropper. Immigrant kids.
Yes. That was definitely like one of those moments where it's like, okay, I got some supper to cook right now. I'll talk to you in a second.
So do you remember Ngeni?
Wait, who?
Okay.
Oh, you're talking about the yes.
Yes.
God, that was so cringy. Oh my God. Oh well, my God.
It's I mean, like, what is going on with this guy? I mean, don't you want to like a phrenologist needs to study Cyril's skull. Like, what is happening? But so anyway, Barlow comes up with an idea and he's like, well, you know, I can solve this problem for you. And the smartest people alive go, really? We'll give you anything. And he's like, I want to be emperor of the whole world and have a golden throne and blah, blah, blah. And they're like, yeah, okay. And so sight unseen, they place him in charge of the world. And but in the middle of that,
let's not forget that they have a secret base in the South Pole.
Yes, yes. The South Pole is the fortress of solitude for the Smarty Pantsers. And in Smarty Pants Central, Barlow is introduced to someone who is briefly his aide, whose name I believe is Alan Ngeni. Certainly the last name was Ngeni.
Yeah, that's right.
And he's like, well, you know, I'm not going to shake the hand of a black man and dun, 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 dun.
It's like, what?
Yes.
What?
And all of the super geniuses are appalled and disgusted by this. And they're like, we won't show a reaction. This is too important. You know, that this racist moron is saving the world.
Look, if we don't accept a little racism, he won't save the world.
Right. I mean, that's fundamentally where this story is so confusing in that way, because it is pushing eugenics so damn hard. But don't call him racist.
Well, no. I mean, yeah, he makes a big point that, you know, not shaking his hand, that's bad. You know,
Yeah, well, you know, so the implication
is... Well, I mean, in fairness, Pete, we, you know, like recently we did, we covered Gattaca, and if there isn't a perfect encapsulation of like the united colors of eugenics, that is exactly it, right? It's like, you can't be racist, but eugenicist, okay.
It's like we don't care what color you are, so long as you can appropriately put, you know, these cubes in the appropriately shaped holes, you know. so anyway, what Barlow does is he starts an ad campaign, and the ad campaign is for Venus. And the idea is like everyone should relocate to Venus, da 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 da. And you know, they actually fake a Venus. They bring people out to a deserted island where they have a lot of fun and stuff, and bring them back. So they tell the population. They insert, like when they do commercials now, it's like, try Sudso soap. Granted, Sudso soap isn't as good as the soap root you can find on Venus.
I love that the ad is like, yeah, we have a shitty product.
And all the psychiatrists are supposed to, you know, prescribe a trip to Venus. And the trip to Venus is a trip to a crematorium, basically. if you sign up for Venus, they fry you. Yeah. And that's what they do, is they take 5 billion people and fry them. And I would like to point that you could just do this without the ad campaign, right? You could be like, hey, dummy, get on this bus. There's candy at the end. I mean, like, this just seems needlessly complex. Like, I'm not claiming that they should have sent me instead of Barlow, though I would have done a better job. I don't even know how to say it.
You would have eliminated the middlemen and the eugenics campaign.
I'm just saying this genocide, in addition to being absolutely horrific and inappropriate, was inefficient.
I mean, they always are, aren't they?
Yes. Yeah. Fundamentally, yeah, that is a good point. So basically, they do end up frying everybody. And at the end, Barlow discovers there's a project going on that he's not aware of, called Paul Propend or something. And he hunts it down And they're like, yeah, we'll show it to you. And they strap him into one of these little rocket ships and cremate him.
Yep. He's like, well, thanks for the Hitler advice. Bye.
Yep. Yep. And that's totally what they're like. We appreciate the, we'd have never thought of that Hitler stuff. And then they nuke him. Right. And so it's like, racism is bad. Hitler was definitely bad. Barlow is bad.
Eugenics and
genocide. Good. Yeah. I mean, it's a conundrum. Let's put it that way.
As some people might say out there, it's a very complex issue, right?
Yeah. So, unprompted, I would like to talk about my history with this story and its background and so on.
Oh, so this is a more of a comment than a question moment for you, Pete. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah,
no, go for it. Go around. I'm just giving you shit.
No, it's all good. So, when the Nebulas came out, one of the major protests that people had was that there are already all of these good stories out there that would never get a Nebula, never get that recognition, just because they were published before the Nebulas started. And so, Heinlein and a number of other authors got together and created a series of books, collections called the Science Fiction Hall of Fame. And if you go to any used bookstore, you will find the Science Fiction Hall of Fame 1A and 1B and 2. And like after that, there probably aren't any. But like those first few are always there. Well, this is in The Marching Morons is in the first book. Like when they were only going to do one. They were like, we need of the 12 most important science fiction stories of all time.
The creme de la creme.
The Marching Morons was one of them. Yeah. And I mean, you got to laugh. I mean, what the fuck? I mean, what is happening here?
Well, I mean, I think one of the things that, and I don't mean to cut you off. This might be a future thing, right? But I think part of it might be that, you know, Kornbluth was part of the Futurians, right?
Yes. Yes, he was a Futurian. And it also ties back to something I was talking about earlier, which is, you know, the science fiction's history is fairly juvenile. You know, it's like, well, what we were dealing with during this era was a lot of STEM people and 12-year-old boys, and between them, there didn't tend to be a lot of sociological or cultural sophistication. And so it was very like thinking, man, it would be great if we got rid of all these stupid people. Then I'd get the girl, right? Like that's all of them were thinking that way from the age of 70 to the age of 10. And I do need to admit that when I read this story for the first time, I was 12 years old and I liked it. And wow. I liked it in a way now that I look back and I find very confusing, because I looked at the beginning and I was like, yeah, oh, God, it's terrible that there are all these stupid people and they're running the world and these poor smart guys. And I get to the end and I'm like, yeah, that Barlow guy needs to die. He's clearly an asshole. It's like no object permanence. Like I accepted the first premise and the second, even though they were inherently contradictory premises.
Well, I mean, I would argue that the central confusion at the center of this is one that we've seen over and over again, right? It's sort of like that very neoliberal. I mean, this is not even in the moment of neoliberalism, but it's the idea that if you get the right people working the machine, that the machine then produces good outputs.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And the other thing about this is it's one of the principal advantages of fascism as a movement or as a sociological phenomena is that it is incoherent. Like
right.
It can mm-hmm. contradict itself. It can mock itself. It can tell jokes. It can, you know, and all of this, you can see why it did so well on like Reddit and stuff. Right? Because like being incoherent and goofy was a big seller there. And you mm-hmm. ended up with the red pill movement and you ended up with all of those pricks. You know, I'm sorry, if we have a big red pill contingent you know, subscribing to Podside.
Fuck off.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Cancel immediately. We don't want you, but
we don't need you. I mean, if
Barlow your ass.
Yeah. If the Patreon goes down to zero tomorrow because of that, well, okay.
Well, I mean, I like, wouldn't you want to know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that is right. That is always the, it always strikes me because that's the type of thing where it's like, oh, but that would cause a conflict. And it's like, no, see, you sort of slowly molding yourself around these people is what the conflict, the conflict's there. You just haven't really noticed it.
Right. I mean, avoiding that does you no favors. I mean, yeah, it would
exactly
at that point, we would start anew and arise from the ashes. Anyway,
or yeah, something, something. Anyway, yeah. I mean, it's such a strange thing because and this isn't to say that all of the Futurians were of the same sort of like political bent, but as I understand it, they originally were sort of like more left leaning. If yes. Not outright Marxist.
Okay, well, let's pause for a second. And Carlo, I want you to pretend that I am the result of an extended breeding program of sharecroppers and immigrants. And could you please explain the Futurians to me?
I mean, to be honest with you, what is it? I don't know very much about
okay,
them.
I wasn't trying to put you on the spot. I just figured the audience is like, who the hell are the Futurians?
So the Futurians was like a little... like a subgroup of people basically based in New York City. I want to say, let me see here.
Frederick Pohl was in them. I know that.
Yeah. Frederick Pohl was in it. There's a Frederick Pohl, Don Wolheim and John Mitchell, Michael. I don't know how you pronounce his last name. Anyway, the point being that it was a very small group and it, you know, sort of accreted other people to them, that then sort of like they had like a goal to make the world a better place via like science fiction and fantasy, science fiction writing specifically. Mm-hmm. So, you know, also another thing that I guess we can talk about real quickly is that then becomes almost a charter for didactic stories, right?
Mm-hmm.
Stuff where the message is just like, here's we're going to hit you in the face with the message, several paragraphs.
Yeah. And I mean, I think, unsurprisingly, the Futurians were fairly incoherent, but if you wanted to, like at least at their origin, they were sort of fluffy leftist with a vein of Trotskyism. Like that was sort of where it started. But like without coherence, these movements drift, I guess is a good way to say it.
Well, I think the issue is that, for instance, you know, like I want to say like maybe 40 years later, you know, during the Vietnam War, you remember it's not the Futurians, it's SIFWA this time around, right? Mm-hmm. Where they had the list of, you know, the science fiction and fantasy authors who were for the Vietnam War and those that were against it. And like a splash page ad, you know, it just, and then at the end, I believe, so I read somewhere that Asimov had a comment along the lines that, you know, like basically, sure, we were on opposite sides of an issue, but we could still work together and blah, 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 because, you know, we were colleagues. And it's like, well, are you though? Because, you know, at a certain point, the goal of becoming a sort of like an affinity group overrides like any sort of politics, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because the interest here is one of the group cohesion. And of course, there is a certain, you know, sort of commercial incentive in the sense that you are now, you know, perhaps in possession or know certain things or can even move certain things in an industry that is already somewhat opaque, right?
Sure.
Which is publishing, you know. Anyway. I don't think it was necessarily to that point at that time, but it is something to think about, right?
Yep. Let's talk Sifwa for a second, because you know we've got some time in this episode.
We figured really quickly. Oh, this story sucks. Yeah,
it's like, well, we aren't going to argue about it. Damn.
I mean, we could set up a point and counterpoint, but why?
So one of my favorite things about Sifwa is that in 1973, they made Stanislav Lem an honorary member. Mm-hmm. And in 1976, they rescinded that because he was a dirty commie.
Well, wasn't that partly because of Philip K. Dick, like thinking that Lem wasn't even like a one person, that he was a collective.
Yeah, like there was a lot of stuff floating around. Like Frederick Paul was insulted because Stanislaw Lem said he was a bad author. Like, you know, there's all this stuff. But Ursula K. Le Guin resigned her membership over that. So let's give her points.
Okay, over them rescinding it.
Yeah. She's like, it's bullshit. He's better than you. Goodbye.
Well, good on her.
Yeah. She like, generally speaking, she had politics I enjoy.
Yeah. But yeah, like, I think it's one of those things that I keep on bumping up against. And it does seem to be like part of those incoherence of a group, right? A social group, affinity group, whatever, what have you, right? Is the this idea that there's going to be like a spectrum of things that you can sort of that is acceptable. Mm-hmm. But like in something like Sifwa or a fandom or maybe even the Futurians, and again, I might be completely off base, because let's face it, the other option is that apart from it just being them being sort of like in solidarity with each other rather than, you know, like towards a goal, it could just simply be that, you know, eugenics was like in the air everywhere, you know, like around the 30s. It really was. It's really difficult to explain just how pervasive it was. And you know, even people that we would consider to be somewhat on our side here in 2024, like, for God's sakes, Helen Keller was in favor of eugenics, and you're like,
right?
You're like, what?
Yeah. Well, and I need to tiptoe carefully here because, let me preface this by saying I'm utterly opposed to eugenics, and nothing good comes of that line of reasoning, and we've seen it again and again. I do understand the attraction. Like, the idea of, like, the problems we face are so overwhelming that the idea of making a smarter human or smarter humans holds some appeal. Mm. It's just the cost is ridiculous.
Well, I mean, I think it's along the lines. I mean, it's different, obviously, but it's sort of like this idea that seems attractive initially because it solves a problem quickly.
Yes. We all like that.
And much like geoengineering, you don't like, yeah, okay, but you know, there's a lot of damage that can happen with this type of thing. So how about we don't do that?
Right. Well, and who's making the decisions?
Well, yeah, obviously that's the other thing, right?
So just like, do you want Elon Musk deciding who has kids?
Well, you know, I feel like to a certain extent there are plenty of people that would be very opposed to like someone like Elon Musk, just one person, you know, because that gives dictator vibes. But if it was a reasonable committee of elected officials,
oh boy,
you know, talk show hosts. I mean, I'm not even talking about like celebrities. I'm just talking about like just good, you know, technocrats just doing their job. You know, Pete. You know, there are people that are just geared that way. You know, they just don't want to have to think about those things.
Yeah. It's very, very rarely do I find myself in the position of agreeing with Robert Heinlein, but at this moment I am forced, and there are just as many people who embrace obedience as embrace defiance.
Hmm.
And I mean, I think that's dead on. I think he's a dickhead, but I think he's right about that.
Yeah, I think that I think that that's also one of the somewhat frustrating, but sometimes encouraging things about being sort of like in a, like in genre, in science fiction and fantasy, because there are, my goodness, there are plenty of texts out there that have really strange politics, gross politics, you know, every type of weird ism that you can find. But at the same time, you can always fish out a couple of diamonds out of that.
True. So I have a story that I want to talk about. I'm sorry, it is actually a novel. Here we go. The Syndic is a 1953 science fiction novel by Cyril Kornbluth. Remember, same guy, our eugenics dude, okay? The prologue introduces... Can I just read this off of Wikipedia? Do I have your permission?
No, go for it.
Okay.
Go for it.
The prologue introduces the setting, a future North America divided between rival criminal gangs, the Syndic on the East Coast and the Mob in Chicago, who have driven the federal government into exile in Iceland, Ireland, and other North Atlantic islands. Life has more or less returned to normal in Syndic territory. As long as the protection money is paid on time, the rest of the world has collapsed either into peasant life or tribalisms. Attitudes to sex are tolerant, with free sex outside of marriage and both polygamy and polyandry accepted. The protagonist, Charles Orsino, is a low member of the Syndic who collects protection money in New York. After an assassination attempt, he's invited to a meeting of the leaders of the Syndic, who suspects that the exiled U.S. government is responsible. Charles volunteers to go undercover to infiltrate the government with a false personality created by his hypnosis to fool lie detectors. He's taken to the main naval base in Ireland. He also visits Ireland outside of government territory. It's tribaled and governed by sorceresses who have genuine powers of telepathy. It's mentioned in passing that England is also tribal and much weaker. And Germany
are they ruled by a mythic king come back from the past by chance?
Well, I remember this from the book because they say that England's civilization collapsed because the people were too good, and Germany's civilization collapsed because the people were too evil.
Wow, okay. We're so good we forgot to find out how to eat.
Yep.
We're so pure, we just stand around looking at the sun.
Yes, and you know, worldwide, everyone knows the jolly good nature of the UK.
Oh my goodness. I do want to give him points for predicting NATO.
Yes. So apparently this book is quite popular with libertarians because of their exploration of anarcho-capitalism.
Ah, yes. The two things that have always worked well together.
Yes. Yeah. Two, like vinegar and cheese.
God, Pete, what the fuck?
So, I mean, I guess where I'm going here is that I would say that Cyril Kornbluth is an intelligent man, but I also think he's been struck on the head.
Well, I mean, you know, maybe he went to the dentist one day and he got zapped.
Yeah. No.
So who knows? Yeah. I don't want to judge Pete.
Yeah, fair enough. But, and you know, I am committing one of the naughties of this podcast, which is I am not separating the author from the work. But like, he keeps doing this. He keeps writing these insane stories about people who are dumber in the future. His other famous story is The Little Black Bag, which is about a doctor who finds a medicine bag from the future that was basically accidentally sent back in time. And he starts using it to make a lot of money and stuff. And sort of as a side note, you discover that everybody in the future is a moron, except for a few smart people who make things like this magic bag that can cure all diseases.
And, seems to be a theme, huh?
Yes. Yes. And I don't know what is with this guy. I mean, how do you fight the Nazis and then come home and go, you know, they should have been nicer about it?
Because eugenics was all over the U.S. too.
Oh, God.
I mean, that I think that that's part of it. There is also, like, you know, I'm certain that there's also other factors that I'm not thinking about because I'm not like a sci-fi historian, you know, like, you know, like a legit one or anything like that. But I mean, it's also like, I want to say that it's one of these things that is pops up over and over. And I think we've had this conversation before, Pete, where, you know, like, you know, fandom, specifically sci-fi fandom, has like this huge chip on its shoulder. Or I mean, it still does, I think, but it really used to have a really huge chip on its shoulder. And then all of its stories had like these more or less the same structure, right? It's the people who know things who should be in charge of things. And it's sort of like just Tin Pot Plato, you know, the philosopher king. You know, you just want to have, all you needed to do was have people who knew, you know, like who the ABCs of sci-fi were in charge of stuff, and that you were hunky dory, you know?
Yeah.
None of these lowbrows. Oof. Sporps? What is that?
Sporps ball.
Excuse me. May I just mention that it's not actually Sporps?
But anyway, comic book guy aside, like he's a stereotype for a reason, right? He's like the comic book guy from The Simpsons is like that because that's how fans often act.
We've all met that guy.
Yeah.
We've all met people who act like that and look like that. I mean, I nearly said it's a stereotype for a reason. It's like some of my best friends are like that.
look, I resemble that remark.
Yeah, it's like, damn it. Yeah. But, so, I mean, I think a smarter person than me would have turned this story and this discussion into a thornier thing for us to navigate, because I think that, how do I put this? On some level, science fiction is, as we know it, is the fruit of the poison tree. Like, I love science fiction. I've spent my life reading it and loving it. But again and again, we find things in it and things that are celebrated which are horrific. And I don't think we're very good at grappling with it. I mean, the closest we come to grappling with it is Silencing Voices. And I think that is the opposite of the way to resolve this.
Yeah, I don't know if I'll be frank and say that I don't think I've ever come across this story like being discussed. In my memory, maybe I haven't been looking around that hard, but I will point out that I don't think that anyone's trying to like suppress it because we could find it.
Sure.
But also I don't think anyone's like really sort of pointing to it as a shining example of,
I
do think that to a certain extent, I think that it's not a question of this being silenced. Not that I was thinking that you were talking specifically about this when you mentioned that, but I did want to point out that I don't think that this is being like suppressed in any way, shape, or form. It's just simply things have moved on.
Right. The best explanation I can come up with that I think is the most accurate is that it didn't age well.
No. I mean, there's a reason that I say this in bad taste, right? Because I don't think it's like, I can't even really judge it for being a good or bad story. It's a story shape. It worked. it's written in a way, like you said, Pete, that is, you know, at the very least competent, right? You can follow what's happening. The premise is sort of what is sort of in bad taste, and then it's so confused that you're like, well, what the fuck was that all about?
Right. Exactly.
It's just like taking a swig of something that you thought was like sweet, but then you realize it's like oil. Why did I do that?
or you grab your water and it's your scotch.
There you go. Yeah. You're just sort of like, wait, what? I am not a fan of the eugenics being portrayed here, but at the same time, like, I think you and I are sort of more accepting that these are the types of things you can run across, right?
Oh, sure. I mean,
older sci-fi.
We could do one about gender politics that is just like, wow.
Well, you don't have to dig too deep for that.
No, you don't even have to go that far back.
Yeah, we don't even have to go to the 50s.
Nope. I mean,
but I do think that I feel like, to your point, however, not necessarily knowing that history or wanting, you know, like that very well-meaning but also somewhat wrong-headed idea of like, this isn't who we really are, right? So you sort of like turn away from the stuff that is problematic. It might be scare quotes around it or not. I don't know. I mean, honestly, to be honest, because there is plenty of like we've been saying, there's plenty of problematic stuff out there. You don't need to dig too deep. But if you just turn away and decide not to look at it, that's one thing. And what happens is that, you know, Jesus, I'm veering into cliche here. I was gonna explain how, you know, history repeats itself in other words, because you can end up doing the same thing. You know, like you end up writing a story that's, oh, but if you're a sweet nerd, you can do no wrong. And you're like, I don't know about that.
Yeah, that's not my experience as a sweet nerd.
Yeah, you can do damage. It's fine.
As a treat.
Yes. I wasn't, to be honest with you, I wasn't like giving permission. I was just simply like, yeah, you
can do a little damage as a treat.
As a treat, yes. You have my blessing, Pete. No, you don't. But anyway, what I'm saying is that, yeah, like, it doesn't really matter. You can sort of mimic that same structure, even if it's not something that's, you know, as problematic as something like this story is, right? I don't know. I don't even know what I'm talking about anymore.
I get it. Well, you know, we're at 50 minutes, so there's a couple of things that I want to crib out of this that I think we can comfortably say are positions of the podcast. The first is that Hitler is bad.
Yes, folks, you do not have to hand it to him.
At all.
Even once.
Now, eugenics is also bad.
Also, yes.
Yes. Okay. Well, I thought that would be a good, like, let's level set here before we go any further.
And then right at the end of the episode, go, psych. No, yes. No.
Stop.
No. These are sincere positions that we both hold. But yeah. I don't know, man. This is a, I mean, honestly, I still say that it's a goofy story in the way it's structured. It really does have that very, sort of 50s, like that 50s era weird structure to it. Well, like if they had just started with Barlow, that was what I was going to say. Like, the funny thing is, as I was reading, I was like, well, I would have started with the dead guy coming back to life.
Yeah.
You don't need to any of the other stuff.
Yeah, like all of that Potter stuff was nonsense. I mean, I think they just wanted to show that he was they wanted to have a moron on set.
Right. They wanted to establish sort of like the setting, and then, but you could just do that. It's so weird to me because you could just do that with the dead guy. He's been asleep for, you know, he's Rip Van Winkle, basically. He gets to envision the horrible future.
Yeah. Well, and you know, if I were one of the geniuses running the world, I would like, I'd set up auditoriums where you kept people with beds, and you know what I mean? It just sort of seemed like what we need to do is hew as close to American culture as the 1920s as we could possibly arrange might not be the most cost effective method to herd 5 billion idiots.
I do love that this is also a culture that is somehow pro eugenics, but somehow they've never figured out that, like, hey, maybe we could just like take control.
Yes. Yeah. You know, well, it's like, God forbid we get rid of the monetary system. You know, it's just.
they needed a guy from the past to bring them all the bad stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. You see, the problem is
Hold on. I mean, apart from, I'm joking, but isn't this sort of like, I am certain that I've run across this same sort of idea before, right? They need to revive. That was the Star Trek one. They needed someone from the past, which is Khan. Remember the shitty Into Darkness?
Oh yeah.
So they needed Khan revived so that they could figure out, well, we need the bombs. We need someone who's a devious mastermind that we will obviously control to help us be bad again. Good the Federation's Lord. Gone too woke. We don't know how to fire guns or phasers.
Unbelievable.
They've eliminated the kill setting on the phasers. You can only stun. What's wrong with these people?
Unbelievable. Yeah, you know, I need to. I don't want to rewatch that, but I can barely remember it now.
It is a convoluted piece of shit.
Okay, fair enough.
I mean, I say this having really enjoyed the J.J. Abrams one, the first one, right?
Yeah.
Fun, okay. I didn't realize that it was just going to turn all of Star Trek into like a mad dash thriller actioner. You're like, what?
Yeah, Star Trek has never been in this. Everything.
Yeah, we're going to reboot the genre too. It's going to become an action flick. That's what it is. Anyway, yeah, I'm making up some of the other stuff, but I'm saying that, like, for instance, the idea that they needed to revive Khan because they didn't, I guess they needed someone who was more devious with battle tactics to engage with war. You're like, huh? Really? This is your plan?
I just sort of refuse to believe that human beings can get that peaceful over the period of what, 50 years or whatever the hell it is. That's ridiculous.
Well, Pete, this is it's a good argument. See, these stories teach people that you got to be on your guard all times. You can't be too peaceful. Mm-mm.
We should end with that.
Yeah, I think so too. All right, well, Pete, I'm going to be on my guard because, you know, can never be too peaceful.
Indeed.
It sets you up for an attack.
Here,
don't like that?
No.
Yeah. No, not here on Podside, but we will thank everyone out there to not attack us.
Yeah,
and for listening in as well too, here on Podside.